So, hello everyone. This is Dr. Will Tuttle, and we're delighted to be able to connect like this on the World Peace Diet Circle call that we're having on the third Thursday of each month, although this is actually a special Thursday call because we were in Asia. We were in India and then in China over the last couple of months, so we were not able to do a World Peace Diet Circle call in October or November, so we're going back to actually September was the last one we had, and now into here in December. So this is the solstice of 2017, December 21st, and it's really a wonderful opportunity to come together and deepen our connection with each other and with our aspirations for a world of more peace and awareness and abundance and respect and kindness for all living beings. So thanks for joining us. And we have quite a few things we want to talk about and also, of course, to discuss if you would like to have give us a question or raise a point about something, you know, this is a great opportunity for that as well. So the call typically goes from 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern time till for an hour to an hour and a half maximum. And so as we usually begin at the very beginning of the call, we like to just take a moment and have something like a little time to tune in and quiet our thoughts, perhaps a minute, and then we'll go ahead and jump into the actual call. So let's take a moment wherever you happen to be right now. If you're certainly if you're driving or doing something where you need to pay attention, then keep doing that. And if not, maybe close your eyes or just get relaxed for a moment in whatever position you are, and feeling our connection that we have with each other and with the whole movement on this beautiful planet. There's a wonderful, vast movement working toward the liberation and protection of animals, all animals, including human animals, and that we can be part of that in some way and deepen our connection with that and with our own inner wisdom. So we give thanks for this precious human birth that we have, opportunity to grow and awaken and contribute to the healing of our world and to also deepen our connection with our own inner wisdom and to be a creative force for the spreading of a message of goodwill and kindness and radical inclusiveness, that we're including all living beings within the sphere of our concern, and that we're leaving out no one, even not only human beings, but non-human beings as well, and exploring the consequences of our conscious mistreatment of animals for food, and also exploring the many ramifications of the positive changes that happen when we move toward a more ethically based way of living that is more inclusive. So we give thanks to all who have gone before us, to all of our ancestors and all the workers over the last hundreds and thousands of years who have contributed to creating a field of freedom and truth and compassion on this earth, and to everyone who's here with us now on this earth, and to those who are to come, to the future generations, depending on us, we include all of them, and especially include all the non-human animals, the beings that we refer to as animals, and who are the subjects of their lives, especially right now, of course, during the holiday season, we're thinking of the so-called food animals, turkeys and other animals who are being abused by people who are disconnected from their source of wisdom and causing suffering unnecessarily. So many beings. So we hold all these animals in our prayers and thoughts, especially right now. And also human beings, that we may question the official stories in our culture that contribute to devastation of our health and our environment and our society, and work together to create a foundation for a world of peace and freedom and sustainability. So we give thanks, knowing that all the ripples that radiate out into the world from our being together here on this call this evening will be ripples that bring peace, healing, and justice and freedom into our world in greater abundance, in the deep sense of the celebratory nature of life and living on this beautiful earth. And we give thanks that we're at the point in our life when we can contribute to the greatest evolution and benevolent positive change that our world has ever seen, at least for quite a few hundred or thousand years. And we can be part of what I refer to in the World Peace Diet as the vegan revolution. So thank you all again for joining us, and we can get on with our call now. I wanted to especially thank Madeline for her all her help that she's been providing over the last few months traveling. We've been traveling first. We flew to London, London and then Switzerland, Spain, England, India, China, including Taiwan and Hong Kong and Hawaii. And so, as you probably all heard, it was quite a whirlwind tour of 75 events in 65 days, roughly in about 40 cities in these different countries, and especially quite a few of them were in countries where the cultural differences were very marked. And we really had a great time, though, all in all. So, Madeline, I'm going to unmute Madeline's phone here and see here. Are you there, Madeline?
Yes, I'm right here. Hello, everybody. Happy solstice. And, yeah, we're very happy to be home. We were happy on the travel, too. It was, like, wonderful, all the experiences and the people we met and the beauty we saw and just seeing how so many more people working on the vegan subject than we're thinking, just being at home here. But we enjoy now having our grand piano and the garden back in our life for a moment till we start again next tour. And it's so beautiful. I can't really tell you how wonderful it is to go into the garden and get nourished by these beings, just without actually physically taking in food particularly, but they're like real beings being around, and they really show if they're cared for. And it's beautiful. It's like such an experience to take care of plants, and they take care of us on the other hand. And I can just not often enough put it to your heart to get a few plants, even in planters or in a little piece of land you have maybe, and have a few wonderful plants growing and giving you material food and also soul food. And then, yeah, the piano, it's so wonderful. I hear we're playing the piano every day, and then we can play piano and flute, and it's like really so rewarding and wonderful. So we enjoy it, and I don't like to make it too long because I know that Will has a lot to say, but I like to remind you of what we talked maybe a year ago about the hot water bottles and turning the heat down some, and especially women who like to have beautiful skin. You know, don't heat at night when you're sleeping, and take a hot water bottle, and it's really cozy. If you have nobody else in the bed, you have at least a hot water bottle, and it's fun. And then also, you know, it's so-called Christmas time, and so many people wish to get what they want, and so many people are depressed because they don't get anything, and we can actually just really make a step and step back of doing all that nonsense buying in the stores to have some gifts, and the other people don't even want these gifts in a way, but we feel obliged, and but we have to do a step and just maybe give something, some good vegan food or some service, or there are lots of opportunities to make this Christmas time a valuable time for everybody, also for the animals, to go vegan and spread the message and invite maybe somebody to a vegan meal or bring a vegan meal. So we can do a lot and still have a warm Christmas time with some lights and some good food. So this is what I like to say tonight, and I pass it on to Will now. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful season, holiday season, and a just great and experiential new year. So happy and joyful. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks, Madeline. That's nice to hear all your encouraging words about the garden and planting. And do you have any, I was just wondering, do you have any suggestions about which, what plants might be good for people if they wanted to just, you know, or I guess you're into herbs more, right? Herbs or
yes.
Right? So I mean, people that just could do a little planting, especially now it's kind of cold. Did you, do you have any, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, any thoughts about just what we can do to have a little of our own food that we can grow ourselves?
I think right now we could actually plant a few things, some greens, especially kale, and some sturdy herbs like thyme and marjoram. These kind of plants, they come very well even if it's cold. And then when it gets spring, just make a little herb garden. Herbs are really fantastic, especially also the pineapple sage. It gives so many leaves on a plant that we can actually use it as substitute in the green smoothie instead of kale. We can use it in wraps, or we can use it as a very delicious aromatic herb.
Yeah, and the hummingbirds love it too.
Yes.
Red flowers every fall, yeah. Pineapple sage, you're right. We use a lot in the lunch and tortillas. And sprouts, too. And sprouts are always a possibility, and on the kitchen sink, counter, I mean. We've been doing that for years too. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, thanks. That's, I know right now with the holiday season on us, it's easy to be consumed by all the busyness and to just say no to dry things. And I think it's a good idea to say no to drinking alcohol, to eating any, of course, any animal foods, doing any of the kind of things that people sometimes do, overconsuming, like you're saying, and really remember that the body is our sacred temple, and everything that we can do to be healthy, actually, in a positive way with our thoughts and our food, help not only helps us, but helps other people, right? So,
yeah.
Great thing we can do for our loved ones as well.
Yes.
All right. Great. All right. Well, thanks, my dear heart. And I'll go ahead and jump on the call now with everyone. And thanks, everyone. Thanks, Madeline. So I'll go ahead and mute Madeline. But anyone can, if anyone would like to say something, as I mentioned earlier, or ask a question, please press *6 on your keypad there, and that should be able to raise your hand, so to speak, and I'll see if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question or say something. And one thing I am wondering, I would like some input on, if possible, from people, is that I'd like to start making some more short videos, just, you know, anywhere from 3 to 7 minutes, kind of short videos on different subjects. And I thought, like, you know, maybe on some environmental subjects like deforestation and oceans degradation and maybe climate stabilization, and also on some spiritual subjects and maybe some of the veganism and spirituality and the veganism and Buddhism or veganism and Confucianism or Taoism or Christianity. And also answer questions, you know, basic questions that people have. So I'll be working, it looks like I had a call with Casey Taft, who are vegan publishers today, and they would like me to do some of these videos, and they'll kind of dress them up a little bit nicer. But it would be nice to have some suggestions. If anyone has suggestions for subjects, for videos, either things you think people should be more aware of, or things that you've noticed that people are unclear about, or myths that need to be questioned and so forth, let me know, because I like to compile a list, and that will make it easier for me to just make these videos, and I like to really do it, especially things that are up for people, and you folks, being the World Peace Diet Circle, going through our training and being really involved with the ideas in the World Peace Diet, I think it would be great to get any feedback you may have or any ideas you may have. So please, you can send me an email at littlepillarearthing.net, or just raise your hand and let me know now, or however you'd like to do it. That would be great. So, but as you all know, Mel and I got back recently. It's been about a week since we finished up our big lecture tour, and we ended up the last couple of weeks in the Hawaiian Islands, first on Honolulu, and then on the Big Island, and then finally in Maui, doing quite a few lectures there every day, actually. Had at least one event. And we were before that in China, before that in India, and before that in Europe. And so now for the resources that I sent, I put up online, so hopefully you all had a chance to see it, or you will. There's more things than usual. It's pretty long. It's 4 pages of resources. And I do recommend that you have a chance to have a look at it. The whole first page practically is taken up by links to our videos and newspaper interviews in India and China and in England. So I think it's great that we got all of so much media coverage for the World Peace Diet ideas in all these different countries. And we also have Judy's poem, Judy Carman, I Am a Vegan Sticky Note, which I think is wonderful. And a great video by Linda Middlesworth, who is a World Peace Diet facilitator, talking about how her health has just gotten so much better. And she's also a wonderful vegan activist. She's the founder of the Sacramento Vegan Society, which is a really active, booming organization. And also Patricia Todd, who's World Peace Diet facilitator, is working hard with helping this whole movement actually in Los Angeles to make all the shelter dogs in the entire city of Los Angeles, the entire county of Los Angeles, vegan. I mean, make the dog food all plant-based. Isn't that great? I mean, that's huge. That's thousands and thousands of dogs and chickens and fishes that would no longer be killed. I guess they're not actually killed for dog food, but that, it's part of the profit for slaughtering these animals, though, is the sale of them, of their bodies to not only for people to eat, but also for pets to eat. So that's a big, very controversial thing that's going on there. And and also Judy Carman's letter to the editor in Kansas newspaper there where she lives, against Tyson's wanting to build a big factory. Of course, nobody wants a slaughterhouse near where they live, but people don't think about that when they go in and buy meat there, that somebody has to be near the slaughterhouse, factory farms that stink so much. It's really terrible. There's also, just to mention it, there's a excellent, I put it in bold at the very bottom of that first page, Bob Comus, Murdering Happiness. Is the name of his title. You know Bob Comus, perhaps. I've mentioned him before. He's a fellow who was the pig farmer. He tells his story, which I just love because it's such a vivid example of the power of the mind and heart to overcome programming, cultural programming. And he was, just to say very briefly, he was at one point, I guess at a certain point in his life, he tried being a vegan, but it didn't go. And then he went back eating meat again, and then he decided to become a pig farmer and grow his own pigs in a sort of conscious way and sell them. He did that for many years. And then finally one day he went to see the process of the slaughtering of the pigs, and it was devastating to him to actually see it. So he was having a sort of huge crisis about it in his mind. He could go on when this woman said to him, "Oh, thank you so much for providing this wonderful free-range, grass-fed, organic ham, you know, for me." And so she was so sincere, apparently, and he just said, "Oh, man, I guess what I'm doing is okay after all." And he went on for a few more years, continuing on raising pigs for slaughter. And she just tells the story of how one day he was walking outside just feeding the pigs. There was cold morning in Wisconsin, I think was where he was, and suddenly, for some reason, he for just a few seconds, he saw the pigs not as objects, not as animals, not as things, not as even as being separate from him. He just had a transcendent experience, a direct revelation of the truth of being, where he saw that he himself as a being and the pigs themselves as beings were utterly interconnected, as he terms it, in an energy field of light that encompassed all of it and together. And when he saw that, the whole sense that he had of being superior to them as a human and then inferior to him as pigs just completely evaporated. And he saw them and him as expressions of one life. And this connection, this very deep, profound connection that he shared with them was so real and so obvious. And it was not mediated by any logic or rationality. It was just a direct heartfelt, heart-awakening realization. And so when it was over in a couple of seconds and the pigs became just pigs again, grunting and pushing on him, trying to get to the seed that he was putting down in the snow, he was a changed person, you know, and that was it. He just didn't get out of the business, gave away the pigs as best he could, and became a vegetarian, and then shortly afterwards became a vegan, and he's now a vegan spokesperson, I guess you'd say, and is a pig. A film about his transformation, which is out now, and I think it's actually quite a good film. I've watched it, and it's called The Last Pig. The only my big complaint about the film actually is that this whole spiritual experience that he had is utterly omitted. It's just not even mentioned or alluded to or anything in the film. And to me, that was the most exciting part, was to somehow show that. And so I'm so disappointed that that isn't even talked about in the film that I'm not that avidly recommending the film, but it is a good film. I wish a film would have something like that in there, because I think the spiritual dimension of veganism is so important, and I think a lot of people I think people do go vegan sort of logically, you know, some make some kind of logical case in their mind, but I think that the overwhelming majority, actually, it's an inner awakening that happens where people just sort of get it. Like a light bulb goes on and people say, now I see it, you know, I'm not going to participate in that anymore. These are, whether it's because of seeing the mothers having their babies stolen or seeing the little babies being castrated and killed, or just understanding a deep level of the devastation to the earth or to our health. But I think in many ways these are intuitive understandings, and logic plays a part. I think it's important to talk in reasonable terms about all of the devastating impacts. But as I always say, if people were really logical and rational, actually, then everybody would be vegan. We wouldn't have any, we wouldn't be going through this problem of trying to get the world to go vegan, because it's so clearly logical to do that, and yet people don't change. So it's clear that we're not logical. We have other things going on, and being part of a group and fitting in are huge. But also, I think the ethical and spiritual dimensions are huge, and they're really forces that can be in our favor as we're working to spread and share the vegan message. And I'm feeling that if you're on this call, you're interested in this dimension, because that is a explicit part of the world peace value. And I think as we travel, especially when we travel in Asia, like in India, China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and we really can feel how the people in those countries that are essentially less materialistic in the philosophical sense of being just deeply programmed that there's no reality other than matter. And I think it's very clear in China as well as in India, there's a strong tradition of what I would call spiritual awareness or awareness of consciousness as being primary, and the interconnectedness of life being primary, that beings are not just separate objects that are born into a kind of meaningless situation that's just held together by random evolutionary laws, or as they're sort of hatched out of the minds of scientists, and because of some nonsensical Big Bang that just happened for some reason. Just great saying by Terence McKenna, scientist. He said, "Scientists say, just give us one miracle and we can explain everything after that." It's one miracle, and then after that we can explain everything. But nothing is explained by materialism, I don't think. And being in India and China, it's clear, to me anyway, we're in cultures where there's a much deeper pool to go swimming in philosophically than in the West, which is relatively shallow. And without the Eastern influence, I think the West really is kind of ridiculously shallow, especially if you cut off the pre-Socratics and Plato. Then for the most part, we end up with a herding culture's philosophy. And what is a herding culture's philosophy? It's already, the people are so wounded, and they have to justify violence and abuse of animals and the domination of women and nature as a sort of foundation of everything, that the philosophy is pretty impoverished, quite honestly. So I just love being in these other cultures where, even though there's certainly a huge problem, but there's an underlying agreement that we're not going to just confine ourselves to the shallows of life, that we're willing to jump in and go a little deeper. And I find that sometimes in the West, people don't think that doing that is, they say things like, oh, you must be smoking too much dope, or they say, where are you? You a hippie, or whatever. Fear, the terror that people have of going more deeply into these things. And I think that's really a big part of the wounding that animal agriculture inflicts on all of us, is this deep wound of seeing animals as just objects, seeing ourselves as an object, seeing the earth as an object. Everything is basically dead. It's deprived of a living or enchanted quality, and everything is utilitarian. And there is this whole movement within the animal rights, or whatever you want to call it, animal protection movement of utilitarianism, which is basically just trying to make others happy. And I personally think, again, that approach to veganism and animal liberation based on utilitarianism, based on the idea that we're all objects, we should just try to maximize pleasure and minimize pain, that it really doesn't do justice to the deeper issues at all. And that's why I like the Buddhist approach, actually. Actually, the Confucian approach is nice, too, that I discovered in China when we were there recently. That there's just that level of, I mean, the Confucian approach is more, do not do to others what you would not want to have done to yourself. The golden rule in honoring all of creation and respecting nature and respecting future generations and respecting ancestors. And so there's a strong component of acting in a responsible way. And so that was one of the big surprises that Madeline and I had when we were going around from city to city and just giving lectures in various venues. And toward the end of our lecture tour in China, we went to several Buddhist and one Confucian temple. And it really changed everything. I mean, Buddhist temples we've been to before in China, and really I love it because there's just this very rich kind of environment with the monks and meditation practice, and the people that come there are extremely respectful and just listen very well and sort of beam in a very beautiful way, their light and their smiles and so forth, and just listen so attentively and take it all so seriously. I just find it very inspiring to see. And the level of commitment and urgency I see when people come to hear us at the temples. But also, we went to Chufu, and I was told that was where that's the birthplace of Confucius, sort of in central China, south of Beijing. So we went to Chufu. It's a small city by Chinese standards, only a couple million people or something. And and they have this wonderful United Nations World Heritage Site, which is the biggest, I guess, Confucian sort of memorial temple anywhere in the world. And we spent some time there. And it's very much non-theistic. And that's one of the things about these Asian religions is there's no God. There is no God involved. And to me, that's, personally, I have to say it's kind of refreshing. Confucianism, there's no God. It's sort of a religion based on harmony and respect for others and for oneself and for nature and so forth. And Taoism is similar in that sense. It's a little bit more, has to do with energy and meditation things, which is more than Confucianism and Buddhism also and Jainism. They're non-theistic religions. A lot of the Indian religions are also non-theistic. So the whole idea that we have to have a god to have a religion, it's absurd. But this particular place where we were in Chufu was dedicated to the healing, really, I guess, was part of the healing power of these teachings. And the way that we can order a society in a harmonious way through these principles that Confucius came up with. And then afterwards we went to a community, and I was just not prepared for the psychologically to see this magnificence of this community. It was really a beautiful place. They had some large buildings that they had built recently, a dining hall, and then a lecture hall, and then a 24 small little cutest little cabins where you could sleep, you know, one, two, three, four people probably. And then they had also built a large main hall, and we didn't really have time to do a tour that evening, but the next morning we did. And that evening, though, we got a real taste of the place, and it's the vision of a group of Confucian devotees, basically, in that area who are creating a completely vegan and organic, no animal inputs of any kind of the agriculture community. They have already bought, they have the land, 4,000 acres. I mean, it's a lot of land. And they've already put millions of dollars into the building of infrastructure and buildings and so forth, and they've got a lot of people involved. There's a lot of people living on the land. They're growing crops. We had delicious meal. Supper was, and it's very simple food. It was some sweet potatoes that they grew on the land and some noodles made from the grain. It's what it was. I think it was maybe stout that they grew on the land and then made the noodles out of. So they just make their own food. It's all organic and veganic. And they have just a beautiful, rich culture of dance, poetry, art, education. The next building they're building is a big building for elders, because a big part of Confucianism is honoring the elders. That's the most important thing. And so, I mean, you know, to me, just, you know, the idea that somebody is building this community and building a building for elders to live here years out in a vegan, organic way, and it's open to anyone. It's wide open. Anyone can move there. And so any vegans in China that want, are getting to their retirement years and want to just live in a, where they can grow their own food and it's all vegan and organic, there's a place for them. I talked to them. They said anyone can buy land and build their little house there. And then they're building a school, a vegan school for children. And so, and then they have, you know, other buildings, houses, and so forth that they, people can build. So it's just kind of in the beginning stages still, but what an amazing thing. You know, it's the kind of thing that why don't we have that here? Why don't we have that in Europe or the United States or Australia, something like this? It just doesn't exist. And yet in China, it's just going full steam ahead. And I just saw so many things like that, this cooperative spirit. Again, you've heard me probably talk about it, but this very cooperative spirit that people have in China, working together in ways that are very inspiring just to see, and how well things went. And again, we had, usually had anywhere from 300 or 400 or 500 people at the events, and they were beautifully orchestrated. We always were very well taken care of and very, you know, overly treated well. They always gave us many bouquets of flowers every night and gifts and very nice accommodations and very careful about the food and very delicious vegan food and lots of vegan restaurants and just whisked around China. A lot of it, instead of like other years where I was flying a lot in airplanes, this time we get to experience more of the high-speed train system in China, where the trains go about 200 miles an hour, and they really connect the cities so quickly, you know, much faster than you can drive. When you jump on one of these trains, it's easy, you know, you just go in, there's no security to speak of, and you just, well, you have to, it's quick and easy security, and then tickets are not expensive, and you just get on a train, and they're clean. I mean, as soon as the train comes into the station, you know, there's women out there, usually when it's men or women, cleaning the trains on the outside, cleaning them on the inside, they're even cleaning them while the trains are going along. You know, people that are hired, there's so many people in China working to keep everything clean. I really, everywhere you go, you see people sweeping. They never, ever, ever use leaf blowers. They never use any kind of electronic or gas-powered or electric blowers. You know, I just love that. It's just all brooms. And the brooms are handmade from branches, you know, and they're just in the front of hotels or parks or in the city streets or by the roads or in front of stores or whatever it is. They're always sweeping, cleaning, washing. And really, I just noticed in the last few years the enormous amount of money the government is putting into beautifying China as well. They really spend a lot of money on infrastructure, building really nice roads, but not just doing the roads, but planting. You know, big trees. You know, they don't just plant little trees. I don't know where they get all these big trees, but they're planting, you know, just acres and acres and acres of pretty large trees, all and flowering bushes and then they really make them beautiful and carve them into shapes. You know, there's a lot of that kind of thing where going along the roads and the bushes are made to look like butterflies and animals and different things. And very whimsical, a lot of art everywhere, yeah, public art. And tree planting is a huge new thing. It's a Blue Skies Initiative. Chinese government authorities have really decided that they want to drastically reduce the air pollution and the coal burning. There's no more coal burning plants at all. Everything's going into solar, wind, and other alternative kinds of energy generation. So it's just nice to see that, and the government also, as you all know, is encouraging people to eat less meat. So our time in China was just beautiful, and they always had a grand piano on the stage, and Madeline was the first time was joining me and playing the flute, and they treated her really beautifully as well. There's a video you can watch if you haven't seen it already of our travel throughout China with some photographs, and also India as well, which was a beautiful experience for us because India is much newer, it's older than vegetarian. I mean, India is the cradle of vegetarianism in the world. China is the cradle of veganism in the world, I believe. That's my feeling, anyway, so at least the outer level, because China never really did dairy. So in India, they always were saddled with this dairy problem, even though they don't meat, although meat is coming back. Unfortunately, under pressure from the West, but I think the Chinese, to me, it seems that the Chinese government has been much more successful in putting up healthy boundaries to keep out Western culture from sort of polluting and destroying their society, as much as Indian culture seems to be much more open and it has been invaded by Western culture more deeply, and I think it's suffering because of that. There's really a lot of suffering everywhere, in a sense, and it's very obvious suffering. You see a lot of hungry kids banging on the windows of your car when you're at the stop sign, and dogs and cows that have no place to go, or eating trash, or sick and dying by signs, you know, just everywhere. And you really see the massive injustice and inequality. It'll be a beautiful Rolls Royce dealership, for example. I mean, it's so ironic to see this Rolls Royce dealership, and then right next to it and around it there are these people living in cardboard shacks. They don't have like a nice part of town for this Rolls Royce. They just have it wherever. And So it's got the incredible contrast. And I have to say that the vegan movement is booming. It's new, but it's fresh and alive. We've got so many beautiful young people that are starting vegan restaurants and study groups and coaching. And there's a vegan school in Calcutta. We spoke there. We spoke at the kickoff in Mumbai, obviously, 18-day vegan festival. An 18-day vegan festival, they had over 100 different events, like vegan cooking classes and lectures and slideshows and discussions and so forth on veganism throughout the city of Mumbai. So it's really great to see a lot of enthusiasm among the people of India. There's no real resource like there is in China of the Confucian temples and the Buddhist temples where the monks really are living a vegan life. And so there's that strong backbone that goes back hundreds of years of veganism in China that I think that's really going to help them move in that direction. It's helping them already. But I think in India there's this profound and ancient respect for the teaching of ahimsa or nonviolence. And so one of the fellows, I remember at one of my talks during the Q&A period, he said that he thought that the vegan movement would grow more quickly in India than in any country in the world. So that's a nice thought, because India has virtually about 1 billion people, and has the largest exporter of meat, the largest exporter of leather, one of the highest rates of diabetes in the world. And India really needs to go vegan. It's terrible what's happening, and the destruction of the environment, the water, dairy is one of the worst things you can do to the environment. We saw that in New Zealand, how New Zealand went from being a really quite a pristine country just in 30 years to being just a more or less a cesspool of pollution, degradation, soil erosion, water pollution, and so forth, because of the dairy industry expanding so quickly. Dairy is just such a destructive force. And I didn't realize it, but India went through these two revolutions that I mentioned in my video, the Green Revolution, which was hard on the country. Africa is very hard, too. Basically trying to get these countries to adopt a Western model, or United States petroleum-based model of agriculture, to get away from local, small-scale, organic agriculture, which really is much more efficient and feeds a lot more people on less land, and to get them to buy machines and buy hybrid crops and buy GMO crops and buy chemical fertilizers, pesticides, fungicides, and all these things. And so that Green Revolution just created a huge amount of suicide, of disease, of water pollution. And but anyway, it made a lot of profits for the wealthy elite. And from there, they went to the next disaster, which was the White Revolution, which was in the 70s primarily, and into the 80s and 90s. The government of India said that people in India are not drinking enough milk and not eating enough dairy products, so they called it the White Revolution. They wanted to just really boost the production of dairy. I'm sure it would be interesting to know how the corporations engineered this whole thing and paid off the government officials to promote this thing. But anyway, that's been an unmitigated disaster. And there's more cows than ever roaming the streets, starving, and more diabetes and more hunger and just environmental devastation because of making an effort to boost dairy production. So that was the White Revolution. And then now, in the last 20 years or so, is what's called the Red Revolution. And that's just basically this big push to have people eat more meat. And that's being pushed by the government also, and, of course, especially by corporations, McDonald's and Burger King, Kentucky Fried Chicken especially, have really moved in everywhere. And so that is taking a huge toll on the agricultural land. It takes so much land, as you all know, to grow grain, to feed the animals, while people end up going hungry and get all the Western diseases. So veganism is understood now in India more and more to be a healthy response in the case of these three revolutions, and to move toward a more local, organic, plant-based, whole foods way of eating and living. And it was great to see a lot of people making these connections, and I could really just speak about this. I didn't have to have a translator in India. They understood English everywhere I went, even though they also had their own local dialect, Hindi usually, or Tamil or Gujarati. Typically, it was one other one, Canada. But they understood English, so I could just rattle away. And when I get to China, I could no longer do that, or Taiwan or Hong Kong. I had to always speak to a translator, which really slowed me down a lot. That's quite frustrating, sort of at a deep level, because I never knew what was going on. Also, in the panel discussions, and the translator told me. And so it was a lot of work, actually, to keep, for the translator and me to be up to speed on the questions and the conversations that were happening. But for the actual lectures, I could speak two sentences typically, then wait while she translated. She was great, my interpreter, Grace. She was an woman named Grace for most of China, and she helped us enormously. But one of these days, it would be nice if everyone spoke the same language, or if I could speak every language. Because we also needed, Italian, we needed French, German, we were in Switzerland. So
Yeah, but the underlying idea is that there's a universal language, and that's veganism. It's also music. And they always had a piano, which was great. Madeline played the flute. So one of the things in China was they really loved music. And we played a lot usually two or three, usually at the beginning, the middle, and the end of each lecture, I would play a piece of music. And that seemed to help the message go more deeply as well. So those are some of the highlights of our lecture tour in China and India. I could say a lot more. We were on Lily's Sunday evening, multi-site Sunday it's called. And I can maybe put a link to that recording. Because I really discussed the so many things about our lecture tour in India, China, that phone call. But I'll just say maybe one more thing. When we were in Europe, we had a chance to really spend a lot of time in England and to see the vegan movement as it's really rolling in England. It was also very inspiring. The Veg Fest drew close to 15,000 people. They had a three-day event this year instead of the usual two-day event. They had a Friday vegan trade show event where they invited all these different vegan products, mainly from England, but also from France and Germany and Switzerland and other countries, United States as well. So there was this, and they all had booths. They call them stalls in England. So it's great to go around. There's so many different, the vegan cheeses, I mean, cheeses are really, there's so many different types of vegan cheese in Europe that we could sample, and vegan chocolate, and vegan leather, and vegan, all kinds of health drinks, and clothes, and foods of various kinds, and vacations, and just everything vegan. On the trade show, and then it was just a great networking time. I had a chance also to do a panel with just one other person, who was James Aspie. Some of you may know James. It was great to spend some time with him and just talk to the crowd there that was there and answer their questions. And really, I like his message a lot. He's if you're familiar with James Aspie, he has had quite a few videos. He was silent for a year, and then he broke his silence. He's Australian, on the Australian television network, telling why he was silent, and about the violence towards animals. And he's a practitioner of Vipassana meditation. He was very kind and generous in his comments. He said the Wolfish Diet was one of the most main inspirations for him in his advocacy. So we really felt, at least I felt, I think he did too, that we're very much on the same wavelength with what we're talking about with our advocacy, not to blame and criticize people, to understand that it's a system, that our society has been essentially taken over by a herding paradigm that is destroying everything. We're born into that. We're born into this belly of this beast, essentially, that's ravenously devouring everything, and we're taught to be part of that and to contribute to it and to be agents of that by eating the meat and dairy products and eggs and working in the jobs and so forth. And veganism is the most powerful statement a person can make in their lives today to not only say no to that ravenous, destructive beast. I don't like to use the word beast, that sounds like animal, but that machine. It's a better word for it, I guess. And also it's simultaneously, of course, it's saying yes to a way of living that's much more sustainable and has within it the seeds of justice and freedom and health and joy and abundance. Because a plant-based way of living is completely sustainable. We can feed everyone on much less land. And this is such great news. That was the thing I really emphasized in my lectures in India and China especially, was just that I was there to bring good news. I'm not coming here from the United States to do any kind of blaming or criticizing or spreading bad news. Just to spread the good news that we can feed everyone on much less land with much less disease and much, much, much less cruelty and abuse from other beings. And each one of us can actually make it happen. Each one of us can change the way we're living, and we can also make an effort to understand the issues more in depth, and we can be creative in finding ways to share this message with other people and work together and cooperate to do that. And as we do that, we can live the short life that we have on this earth in a meaningful way. Where instead of contributing to the terrible problems that we have here, we're in some way contributing to the solution. So that was the main message, and then going into it, of course, in more depth. And we were accompanied by Dr. Li Yu again for quite a few of the lectures. He likes to talk about the nutritional benefits of a plant-based diet. I always emphasize more the cultural, psychological, spiritual, social, historical, anthropological dimensions, as well as the environmental dimension, and also the nutritional dimension, the health. They're all important. But I think, both India and China, there's deep appreciation for the bigger picture. And we had a chance to do a workshop in India, like an all-day workshop, which was great, working with Dr. Nandita Shah, who's probably the best-known vegan MD in India. She's a tireless worker for bringing the plant-based message really to people, but she's also in it for herself personally because of the abuse that she manages. She's an MD, talks about the many health benefits a plant-based diet. And she's had great success in converting people because of the runaway diabetes and obesity in India because of the white and red revolutions that are happening there. All right, so I'm just wondering, I've been talking now for just about an hour, and I'm wondering if anyone has any questions or anything you'd like to share, any comments about what I've been talking about or anything Madeline said. We have this wonderful opportunity to share ideas. I certainly can go on here, but I really encourage anyone who's interested in pressing *6 to ask a question or to state something that you think is on your mind or heart lately, having to do with any issue in the vegan movement or the animal rights movement. Because I think, this is such a perfect forum. I can definitely, happy to have a monologue here, but I'm also happy to hear from you folks. If anyone has something they'd like to have me address. One of the things that I saw at a deep level, is the role that veganism plays in both dividing and unifying humanity. I think that's an interesting thing. Like when we travel to Unity churches, for example, or many places, really, Unitarian church, any church organization, there's this basic fear, I think, on behalf of the ministers and the spiritual leaders of communities that are oriented around spirituality and religion, that the vegan message is dangerous because it could divide the congregation. As soon as you bring in a divisive message, because you could just talk about love and forgiveness and abundance and kindness and caring. Everybody agrees. There's no division. Everybody can contribute and say, help out. But as soon as someone says, but what about the turkey we're eating? Or what about the burgers we're having? Or the fish that we're eating, the fish fry? Then it feels very divisive. Because that person is saying, wait a minute, I'm questioning the food of our community. And, communities organize around food. That's the main, that's the main ritual in any community of the meals. People eating food together, that's what kind of binds us. It's our deepest connection with nature. So it's very divisive. And so leaders shy away from ever bringing this up. And it makes it very hard, I think, for us as a society to ever make any progress. because we're afraid to do anything that's divisive. And I want to really emphasize that I think, yeah, on the surface it's divisive, but already we have a divided society. Already the divisiveness in our world is we're tearing our world apart. We're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of species in 65 million years. I mean, if that's not divisive, I don't know what is. We're just destroying ecosystems and building so many weapons of violence and destruction. We call it self-protection, but again, these are all symptoms of massive divisiveness. Animal agriculture at its core is divisive. It's basically dividing humans and separating us from nature, separating us from animals, and putting us in the role of being the ones who dominate, exploit, and abuse other beings for our own benefits. That, if that isn't divisive, and it's the foundation of a wealthy elite class. This whole emergence of a wealthy elite came with animal agriculture and the arising of herderism as an organizing principle, where you have competition for land, for agriculture, for animal agriculture. Gardening societies never had that kind of competition for land. And we can see as soon as we have nomadic herders, we have terrible violence, we have a machismo, the role model of boys to be the hard and tough and disconnected, and the whole rising of seeing the female as an object to be impregnated and used for giving birth to animals for wealth, or to sons for wealth and power, or to slaves, again, for wealth, just impregnating females for one's own benefit. And that's the core of animal agriculture, and then confining other beings, killing them. So I don't see what could be more divisive than that. And yet people are afraid of veganism for being divisive. You know, so what we see when we travel is the profound unifying force of veganism, because we come into a country and we don't speak the language, we don't know the customs, we're from another whole dimension, really, and yet we are so unified by our common agreement, which is what veganism is, basically, of respecting animals and not eating them, and trying to do the best we can to defend them, that we feel this beautiful sense of a gigantic family, in a sense, or a gigantic community, a vegan community that exists throughout the world. It's a unified community. And I think it's really important for us in our activism to do what we can to help the community to stay unified. And I loved, we got this calligraphy from a Confucian master. Usually we think of calligraphies coming from Buddhist masters, you know, Buddhists are the ones that do the Zen calligraphers and so forth. But he was Confucian, and he gave us this calligraphy that he had done himself. And I think there was like three main characters. The first one said, a character for the word united or together, something like that. It means that kind of a meaning, together. The second character was the word for but. And then the third was different. You know, so the idea of united or together, but different. And Confucianism, I think they really talked about that a lot, really emphasizes the idea that there's a fundamental unity to life and to a community, but it does not mean we have to all be the same, you know, in any way. So, sort of the French vive la différence, the differences are what make everything so beautiful. And I think in the vegan community, we're united by the underlying moral foundation of not killing, stealing, and lying, and abusing, sexually abusing other animals, and not contributing to that. So that's a unifying. Plus, we don't tolerate that. That's of course not something that is really negotiable. Just like we don't tolerate that to humans. I mean, essentially, we don't want people to do that to each other. We don't approve of that. It's the same thing with animals. So we just include the animals. So it's radically inclusive. But the but the idea is though to celebrate the differences. I mean, it doesn't mean we all have to do activism the same way. Some people really are not interested in bringing this message to other people. They would rather work with governments, say, you know. And some people say, oh, it's a waste of time to work with governments. Don't do that. But, I mean, why say that to somebody who just loves working with governments? If you want to work with the government, you know, maybe I'm not right. Maybe working with governments can help. And some people say, you know, oh, you should only work with governments. You know, don't work with people. That's too slow. You got to work with the government. But, again, if people don't want to work with governments, we shouldn't tell them that they have to work with governments or if they can't do anything. And some people want to use, arts and craft. Some people want to use videos and music, and some people want to use somewhat aggressive or confrontational approaches, and some people want to use very gentle approaches. You know, I mean, I can't say that I know what's the best way to bring this message. I think in many ways we need to rely on the inner wisdom of ourselves and our movement. I would just say that it's really important to encourage anyone who's in the vegan movement to take time every day meditating. Take time every day turning our attention within and contemplating our true nature as best we can, listening, so that we're not just a product of our culture. Because if we question the vegan program, that's great, you know, but that doesn't mean we're questioning all the programs. And I think a lot of people are vegan and they're still perhaps have racism or sexism or competitive, critical, blaming, shaming, angry dimensions to themselves because of the wounding we've all gone through. So we really have to realize that going vegan is just, in some ways, just the beginning. It's the first doorway, but there are countless more doorways that we can go through on our ever ongoing adventure, journey, veganism, and personal growth and awakening that probably never ends. So within that context, to just do the best we can to see the best in other people and affirm the best in other people, whether they're vegans or pre-vegans, and not hold them back by blaming them and shaming them and criticizing them for what they're doing, because we're all wounded. I think that's the bottom line, and it's the wounds, really, that cause us to contract and maybe strike out or feel hurt and so forth. And the best way to heal wounds is through love. Love is power that can heal the wounds, and love and creativity, I think, together really create this beautiful celebratory quality, which we saw so much in India and China. We saw it in England too, actually, in Europe. But especially in China, they just love dancing and singing and creating. You know, I told that story about the airplane, so that was so funny when they noticed for some reason. I'll just tell the story briefly. We were Mel and I were, you know, I was speaking, and then Ellen would do some flute playing, and we had her paintings up. And after I think the second evening in China, they asked us to please share from the stage some of the secrets to a healthy and happy and harmonious relationship, because they just thought that we looked so happy together, and they were wondering, you know, what do they do to stay so happy, you know, as a couple. And so we said, all right. So we shared some different ideas about, you know, being vegan, of course, is an important foundation for a healthy and happy relationship, whether it's a personal relationship like husband and wife or within the family, or I think even friends and colleagues. It's very helpful as a foundation to be not eating animal. And as soon as we're eating animal foods, gosh, we're bringing in misery, violence, and terror, and pain, and suffering, and we're pretending that, you know, we're not doing that. And so it's very hard, I think, to have deep, healthy relationships if we're not vegans, actually. But anyway, so we talked about veganism, and also about having a common mission that we share together and a vision that we are working on that's meaningful to us, and about eating our meals together with joy and gratitude and working together and various different things. And at one point, Madeline just mentioned something. It was not a big thing, really, but she just mentioned that in the beginning, because I think somebody said, did you ever have any arguments or something? And we said, yeah. I mean, especially in the beginning, you know, Madeline was from a different culture. She had a different life. She didn't speak English very well. There's a whole different set of assumptions about the relationship between men and women in Switzerland than in the United States. And so we were like stepping on these minefields and getting upset with each other. I can kind of laugh about it now, but back then it was like, oh my gosh, you know, well, this lady's nutty, or she's crazy. So we would have these difficult times, and at one point I remember, it was so neat because I can still remember that, the feeling I had of like, oh man, I don't know how to get over this. I was kind of angry with her, but I didn't want to have this wall between us. So I wrote a note, and then I just couldn't even bring myself to give it to her. So I just folded it up and bent it into a paper airplane, and I flew it over to her at her desk. And you know, this was like 25 years ago, you know, in this little house we had way out on the dirt road in California. And fortunately, she kind of laughed, and it did its purpose, I guess. It kind of helped bring the harmony back. Anyway, we just mentioned, you know, trying out these different tricks, you know, and we mentioned that to the end. So, and then we went on with the evening and played a little music together, and then took the train the next morning up to the next city. And it was a similar thing that, you know, big, tall, 500 people roughly, and they always serve tea in this, not always, but quite often they would serve tea as part of, because it would take the whole afternoon, the lecture and the Q&A. I realized at one point that they must have heard about this paper airplane thing, because volunteers made like 500 paper airplanes and put one on every single table next to every single seat in the entire auditorium. And so Madeline and I realized that, and she said, you know, I think we should have them write a love note on the airplane. And I said, yeah, that's a good idea. So when I was giving my talk, they asked us to do the same thing, to give some tips, and we said, I think it would be great if you, everybody just wrote a love note on your, or a note of appreciation or encouragement, or whatever you want to say, on your airplane, and toss it to somebody. And of course, you can't toss an airplane to somebody. They go all over the place. But it was so fun to see how they just loved that. I mean, they really got into it. And it was, for the whole rest of the evening, there were these silent airplanes, you know, just kind of going in the background. People were throwing these notes. And then at the very end, there was this grand finality. And the chorus came out, the choir, they had been working on a song. And they had themselves had about 200 planes, I think, and they were singing, and then they started throwing so it was really a wild scene with singing and dancing and their paper airplanes flying. But that was the point, I guess, for me. It was like, I just realized that I hadn't thought about this for 25 years. And so, but 25 years earlier, there I was in this very sort of dark place. I mean, I was feeling hurt and alone and not understood, and I just made an effort, you know, in my own best way to try to bring a little, you know, love and healing into the situation by sending this little note by the paper airplane. And then it was like that seed that I planted there just disappeared into the earth of the universe for 25 years and incubated for 25 years and got bigger and stronger on some level, because all of a sudden, on the other side of the world, it just burst forth as this whole evening of paper airplanes flying and people laughing and singing and dancing and everybody sending all these good wishes to each other. And I just thought, you know, that's the thing. You know, we don't know when we do something, when we plant a seed, if we just smile to someone or have a moment to be kind and loving to them, or, you know, in the seeds that we're planting just every day by buying organic vegetables and fruits and grains and nuts and seeds and so forth. But we're planting seeds, and they go into the living soil of the universal energy thought field. And everything goes there, and it incubates, and it comes forth, and it may come forth in ways we can never imagine, and we may never see. I'm sure we never see it. You know, I mean, every once in a while, you know, we hear someone say, "Oh yeah, that what you said really touched me and it really helped." But so many times, they won't be able to tell you that. So I think the key here is to take the bigger view and realize that, you know, for 10,000 years we've been imprisoning and tormenting and killing animals for food, and we're raised into a system that's still doing that. Those are the seeds that have been planted for thousands of years. What can we do? We can plant seeds on a higher dimension, a more inclusive, loving dimension, with every thought, word, and deed. So every day is an opportunity. Every moment, really, is an opportunity to do this. And as we take advantage of that in our life every day, there's no room, really, I don't think, to feel depressed or to feel nothing's worth it or whatever, because every moment we can do something to make someone else feel a little better, or to learn ourselves, or to contribute in some way, to try to set up our lives more and more so that they are an expression of who we are as a spiritual being, as an eternal expression of consciousness, which is what we are, and to make an effort to understand this, to take time every day to listen internally and to collect ourselves, to reflect on our true nature as consciousness rather than as simply being a material machine, a body, with a programmed story and a name that was given to me. I didn't even choose it usually. And you know, this whole kind of shallow surface level of a mask, the persona, our personality to present to the world, that there's something much deeper, and that is a great mystery. And but it's also a great open fountain of wisdom and giving, the more we can open to what we are truly, and then let our activism as our daily life flow from that. And there's really deep ancient wisdom traditions of people that have been open to this and have been doing this, actually, in other countries especially. I think in Asian countries, I think probably here too, there's this wonderful basic mono myth, Joseph Campbell called it, of that he found in virtually all of the cultures of the world, that there's this common thread that unites virtually all cultures of a time, an earlier time when life was more harmonious, where animals were not afraid of people, and where we lived in harmony together. So whereas we can see that perhaps it's hard to see that in our culture, if we go back, maybe we do have roots of harmony. Now, one of the things that I think is harmful in our society is the way history and prehistory are presented to us. And I think it's probably false. I'm pretty sure it's false. But you know, the basic story that we get is that we're so lucky to live today in a civilized world where we have refrigerators, toilets, and airplanes, cars, and computers, and the people who lived in the earlier times, it was cold and dark and brutal in the medieval period, in the Dark Ages, and going back, it was really bad, and then you could go back before all that to the pre-literate times, or to the sort of the old Stone Age, Paleolithic times. Then people, it was a really dark and brutal time. People were just kind of clunking around with clubs, hitting each other over the head. And we were very primitive, barbaric, you know, people. And we've been ascending ever since then, you know, and that idea. And the thing is that if we had a sense today that people who were living in these earlier times actually were pretty happy, and they had a lot of free time, and they cultivated their relationships, and they lived in harmony with nature and animals, and were really happy. I mean, think of it. People would say, oh my gosh, why am I going to this cubicle every day to sell and spending all my time trying to make money to buy things I don't really want to need? You know, they would say, this it was better before, you know. So we get this continual propaganda that this is the only way to live. So this high-tech society based on consuming. And we have all these rituals to support that and all these official stories and everything. Academia, all the world, all the official stories. We're all forced, really, in many ways, to take all this in and believe at a very deep level. So I think there's no greater gift we can give ourselves than to question everything, to question these stories. And, maybe there were earlier times when we were actually living at a higher level. I mean, there's still, it's fascinating to go to some of these places where mysteries are still unsolved about the creation of some of the things like pyramids and so forth. We don't know who did these and how they could do them. There's many, many other things. There's a great saying by Chuangzi. He says when life was full, that people made no history. You know, that basic idea that when we're living in the present moment, we're living in a whole other way. And maybe this profusion of information that the computer age is giving us, is that a lot of the information is just false news. You know, it's just a bunch of lies. And we're getting swamped in all of that. So to simplify our lives, to take time every day to connect with our own hearts and wisdom, and to realize that we just have a few years on this beautiful earth to question the official stories and to bring our lives more and more into alignment with our values, and to help others to do the same thing by planting seeds. And what a great thing. I think it's so great. So anyway, nobody pressed star 6 that I can see, so I don't have any questions I have to address. And we're just about at the end of our time also, and I apologize if I didn't cover anything you were hoping I would cover. But just to close here, there's quite a few things I'd like to draw your attention to on the resources. It's 4 pages. It's really long. But the ones in, I started doing this bold type, you know, the Bob Comus one, and also the Glenn Greenwald. He's a fabulous, one of the only journalists left in the United States, actually. Not many left. There's a few. And most of them have sold out. Unfortunately, the CNN and NBC and New York Times, which are a bunch of lies, basically. But he has a great article on the FBI's hunt for missing piglets, revealing the barbaric treatment of factory farms and how Smithfield, you know, these two little piglets were on a dead pile. It really were worth nothing, literally nothing to Smithfield, since the Wayne Shung, who's a good friend of ours, and DXC, Direct Action Everywhere, went in and rescued these two pigs. Now they're the FBI's on this big hunt to find these two pigs. You know, they wanna, and they're hassling and terrorizing animal sanctuaries and really doing whatever they can to discourage people from having animal sanctuaries and protecting animals. And it's just really outrageous. Very important. Very good article. But again, it's I think it's helpful to see how the FBI has become completely corrupt and is basically a wing of a large financial corporate complex. The next article after that, human ancestors were nearly all vegetarians, actually vegans. And this is becoming more and more obvious. Even when the World Peace Diet came out, it was becoming, 10 years ago, actually almost 12 years ago now, it was pretty obvious then, but as the research in the last 12 years is more and more turning up that the earliest humans were eating plant-based foods and not dairy, certainly not dairy. And then there's quite a few other, I won't go through all these, gosh, there's so many, but, you know, just check it out and see which ones. These two two helpful videos. That's in bold. I really recommend seeing those. They're not directly vegan movies, but they explain a lot, really, about the system we have, how money dominates it, and the money really comes, again, for, of course, from the military, industrial, medical, pharmaceutical, media, banking complex. That tiny 0.1%, I think it's 0.01% of the people in the United States. I think it's 86 families have like almost half the wealth. And it's really extremely skewed. And this kind of shows that. And I think, again, the World Peace Diet is about getting to the roots of problems. And this is showing very much how the injustice in our meals comes back to the injustice in our society. And so anyway, there's quite a few interesting articles that have come up over the last 3 months. And any other ones, just jump out of here. Arnold Schwarzenegger's new diet, setting alpha males straight. Yeah, it's really great to see Arnold Schwarzenegger coming out saying that going vegetarian, going vegan is really the best thing that anyone can do. And it's great to see how What the Health, the film by Kip Anderson, who's one of World Peace facilitators, is really doing well and creating a lot of positive ripples in the world. And this one down here, Dr. Milton Mills responds to Joe Rogan and other What the Health claims. That's a great video. Also, I highly recommend if you have a chance. And Hector International does more harm than good. Another good one. And there's a lot. Oh, this is interesting. And Matthew Fox, I talked about him in the World Peace Diet. He's just started this new order. He said it's not a religion, it's an order. The order of the sacred earth. Isn't that beautiful? I think it's a great idea. He's not a vegan. I think if he really wants to do an order of the sacred earth, then it should for sure be vegan. He's, anyway, something moving in the right direction, I think, for sure. And I love this little comment. I have these two photos on the bottom. One is somebody has a bumper sticker they've made, Read the World Peace Diet. And but another one is, I understand, this guy talking to a pig, I understand that you don't want to be killed and eat, but stop pushing your beliefs on everyone else. Isn't that great? That's great. So this is kind of what we're up against, in a sense, is this this idea that everyone has a free choice to eat whatever they want. We shouldn't push our ideas on other people, but imagine if we were the pig speaking to the people. And in a sense, we are. If I'm speaking to people, I am the pig, I am the cow, I am the fish, I am the chicken, because they're not able to speak. And we, as humans who understand this, we are able to speak. So to speak in ways that people can understand us, and to realize that we are not pushing our ideas. Venus is not pushing our ideas on others. Eating animal foods are definitely pushing our ideas on other beings in the most extremely brutal way we can ever imagine. So thank you all so much for joining us on the call. If you have any feedback at all, feel free to send an email. That's probably the easiest way. I can include it with the notes that we'll send out. I usually send out the notes the same night, tomorrow morning. I'll probably do it tomorrow morning. And send you all an email of that. And let's see. Otherwise, I think we are all set for this year. Happy solstice to everyone. Thanks again for all your efforts in bringing healing to our world. And our next gathering will be in January. As you know, the third Thursday of January is the 18th. And we will be actually on the road then. Just want to let everybody know we're going to be leaving on January 11th and doing lectures in San Jose, and then with Jenny Jones and Lisa Levinson. They're kind of founders or co-founders with Judy Carman of the Being Spirituality Movement and IDA in Defense of Animals, and Lisa Levinson, I think, have been working on that. So we'll be participating in teachings there, in San Luis Obispo and Santa Maria, and then flying to Florida and doing some lectures in Florida, also especially at Hippocrates Institute, and some other place, I think in Tampa, Orlando, Gainesville. So if you know anybody in Florida or Southern California or Arizona, or if you yourself are there, let me know, because we'd love to come and do presentations, work together, and do some lectures in these places. While we're going to be there, we'll be back up here again at the end of February, and Northern California back home. And then in April, we're going out again on a shorter tour to Southern California. And then doing, we're also doing a lecture tour up to the Northwest in August, I think to Las Vegas in June, and then probably to China in May, and to China and other places in November. We're thinking maybe Bali, then Indonesia, Malaysia. Also probably Portugal in September, and some other European countries. We're looking for people to help translate other languages. Again, if you know anyone who has a skill in another language, right now we're looking especially at Indian languages, as well as Japanese and Portuguese and Greek, I think. Quite a bit of interest in those countries. So I think, but otherwise, we send all our love and thanks again, everyone, for joining us on the call. Wish you a fabulous new year. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and bringing the vegan message at the holidays, I think, of non-consumerism. Just, you know, not cutting down trees for a Christmas tree, and not eating a turkey, not killing animals, not buying a bunch of stuff, like Melon said. Really taking time to contemplate our own existence, to do service work, perhaps in some way to help feed people or bring helpful gifts to people who could use them. Perhaps, you know, socks are always good for homeless people. Things like that, I think, you know, this is really always a good way. Christmas is 365 days a year, as far as I'm concerned. This vegan spirit is the spirit of Christmas, the spirit of giving, the spirit of love, the spirit of caring. And that really, that's what brings us together here on this call, is the spirit of caring. So thank you all for caring. All our love to you. Look forward to seeing you in January. And maybe seeing you out on the road as we're traveling. And stay in touch. And again, much love to you all. I think we can close with, what would be a good one? Maybe the little, got a few different songs here. By the way, we have sheet music now. It just came out of all 14 of my pieces. So if you know anyone who would like to be able to play one of my favorite pieces, like Benediction of Light, It's the Arctic Moon, quite a few of them. We have the music now. All right, maybe Leela. Leela's a fun one. Leela is the one that means play in Sanskrit, divine play, joy, and much love.